Hello everybody. I'd like to welcome all of you to today's teleclass. We're really pleased to have Dr. Alan Johnson, who's going to come and talk to us about surveillance of antibiotic resistance. Alan is a clinical scientist in the Department of Healthcare-Associated Infection and Antimicrobial Resistance at the Health Protection Agency Centre for Infections in London, which is obviously in the UK, where he heads a group undertaking surveillance of antimicrobial resistance. Prior to moving to this position, he worked in the Antibiotic Resistance Monitoring and Reference Laboratory, which is also at the Centre for Infections, and was responsible for the reporting of susceptibility test results for clinical isolates of bacteria received from hospitals around the country. While working in the reference laboratory, he had a research interest in the activity of new antibiotics against bacterial strains resistant to currently available agents. Dr. Johnson was recently appointed as the Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Antimicrobial Chemotherapy. We are thrilled to have Alan share his thoughts on such an important and topical subject. So to present his teleclass on surveillance of antibiotic resistance, can I introduce Dr. Alan Johnson? Thank you, Alan.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to be talking to you. Well, for the next hour or so, I'm going to be talking about surveillance of antibiotic resistance. And if you switch on to your next slide, you'll see that we undertake surveillance in order to understand the epidemiology of antibiotic resistance. That's to say, to get an understanding of the prevalence of resistance in different types of bacteria, and to try and get some sort of understanding of the patient populations who are affected and what sort of diseases this impacts on. Now, surveillance, in essence, involves the collection of relevant data that inform as to the prevalence of antibiotic resistance. That's to say, we generate data that gives an indication of the extent of the problem. As shown in the next slide, there are a series of steps involved in undertaking surveillance. Firstly, and obviously, the data needs to be collected. When you've collected it, it needs to be stored, and this usually involves setting up a database for storing it, usually in the form of electronic records, although it could obviously be done on paper, but increasingly in these days of information technology, it's done electronically. Having stored your data, it's then critical that you actually analyze it to find out what is going on, and the analyses can be done at regular intervals, depending on the types of problems that you're looking at. Most importantly, once you analyze the data and you think some messages are coming out, this information needs to be made readily available to the people who need this information. excuse me. In the past, this has tended to involve publishing the data in peer-reviewed scientific journals, but this process can take quite a long time, perhaps anything from 6 months to a year. So increasingly, there's a trend towards additionally making data rapidly available on the internet, and a number of websites, including that of the Health Protection Agency, try to provide data in a timely fashion. And lastly, having generated all this information, clearly one hopefully has a feel for what's going on. But the crucial thing is one needs to try and act upon it, to put the data to good use, and perhaps try and think of new interventions or strategies that could be implemented with a view to trying to resolve any clinical problems that you're seeing. And in this case, obviously, it's the high incidence of infections caused by antibiotic-resistant organisms. In the next slide, there are just a few examples of how to make use of surveillance data. Obviously, it will guide empirical prescribing of antibiotics by doctors. As an example of this, it is well documented from surveillance studies that the overwhelming majority of strains of Staphylococcus aureus are resistant to penicillin because they produce enzymes that break the drug down. And therefore, one would not, as a matter of course, give penicillin to treat an infection that was thought to be caused by Staphylococcus aureus. One would either give a beta-lactamase-stable penicillin, such as flucloxacillin, or a different class of drugs altogether, such as glycopeptides. And that's an example of where a knowledge of the high level of resistance will guide empirical prescribing. It also gives us some information on the burden of disease and some guide us as to what sort of resources are required for dealing with the problem. And obviously, in terms of hospitals, if you know you have a high level of antibiotic resistance, This would indicate that perhaps you need more in the way of infection control staff to be trying to deal with the problem. So it's an important guide for management in terms of where they're trying to decide to allocate resources. It can also be at the level of not just local level, but also at the level of government. So, for example, in the UK, for a number of years now, there has been a government-backed policy of trying to reduce prescribing of antibiotics with a view to trying to cut back the selective pressure that helps resistant organisms emerge and then spread. So these are examples of the ways of trying to make use of the surveillance data. Obviously, if one comes up with potential intervention strategies, and it could be at the level of a local hospital where you perhaps start isolating patients or increasing your infection control activity, or indeed, as I've mentioned, with government trying to reduce antibiotic prescribing, you need to then continue your surveillance to obviously see if the intervention that you've introduced actually has any impact. And clearly, if your surveillance then shows that resistance starts to decline, it will be a strong indicator that the interventions that you've introduced may well have worked. Moving on to the next slide, as you will see, there are different approaches to undertaking antibiotic surveillance. The first and perhaps the commonest, as the name suggests, is where you undertake surveillance on a continuous basis. That's to say you have data sources and you're deriving data and storing it in your database on a continuous basis. But in contrast to that, we may occasionally carry out what are called point prevalence surveys. And these are essentially snapshots in time. And just to give you one example of that, colleagues working here at the Centre for Infections undertake annual prevalence surveys of resistance in gonococci. These are the bacteria that cause gonorrhea. And every year, over a three-month period in the summer, that's July through to August, they have a panel of hospitals who've got special clinics, and all the isolates that are obtained from patients are sent to the reference lab for susceptibility testing. And they do this survey every year in the same 3 months, and it's over a number of years, it's given very good data on trends in resistance, which in fact have resulted in national guidelines for the treatment of gonorrhea being amended. Now, one may ask, why do they do a point prevalence survey rather than doing it continuously? And it's simply really a question of the available resources. The lab has got limited resources, and so they found that by focusing all their efforts into collecting all the isolates over defined time periods and then studying these isolates in detail during the rest of the course of the year, analysing the data, writing reports and so on, they're then through to the next time period to carry on. So it's the different types of surveillance all have their individual strengths and weaknesses, but by pooling the different approaches, one gets a very good overview on what's happening in terms of the problem under investigation. Looking at the next slide, we can see that surveillance can vary both in terms of the scope, and one may undertake surveillance at the local level, and indeed if you're working in a hospital, one would hope that your microbiology department is actually undertaking surveillance so you have a good idea of what the local resistance problems are. Active surveillance in hospitals can also rapidly detect things like outbreaks in special care units and so on, which may perhaps be delayed in terms of their recognition if you weren't actively monitoring what was happening. You can also undertake surveillance at the national level, and for example, the Health Protection Agency, as a government agency, tends to function at this level. But there was also increasing interest in looking at the problem of resistance at an international level, and I'll be coming back onto this particular aspect very shortly. In terms of the focus, one can look at particular species of bacteria in terms of the rates of resistance that we're seeing, and this is an approach that we commonly take with a lot of our surveillance studies. Equally, one can look at resistance rates in certain types of diseases. So here, for example, one might be interested in looking at perhaps meningitis or pneumonia or urinary tract infections. These are all infections caused by a range of different types of bacteria, and one would need to be collating the resistance data for all of the different species. But if you have accurate data on all the individual organisms causing a particular disease, this does allow guidelines for empirical treatment to be formulated by advisory bodies or national committees. And all the recommendations that are put out usually are based very much on the results of surveillance activities, telling you which drugs do or don't work in terms of specific diseases. Equally, one can look at different patient groups, and examples of these would be one might be looking at patients in intensive care units or patients who are perhaps neutropenic following cytotoxic treatment for cancer and so on. All these different groups of patients have particular underlying clinical conditions that predispose them to particular types of infection, and they may receive antibiotics as a result, and this generates a selective pressure. So it's you get a lot of information from surveillance as to likely treatment options in particular groups of patients. Moving on to the next slide. It's obvious that if one's undertaking surveillance, and this can be any type of surveillance at all, you need a source of data. Now, for the subject of antimicrobial resistance, we know that hospital microbiology laboratories routinely identify bacteria from patients, and they will also test them for antibiotic susceptibility, which means that hospital databases around the country have got vast stores of data that are there. And what we tend to do in the Health Protection Agency as an organisation is to try and elicit the help of microbiology labs around the country to provide us with their data that we can collate and analyse centrally. And over a period of time, we can generate vast amounts of data which can be analysed to look at trends in resistance. So obviously, if one is, as shown on the next slide, if one is doing surveillance, the first thing is that you need a panel of sentinel laboratories who will actually provide you with the data. From the point of view of national surveillance, as I say, we often try to elicit all hospital microbiology labs across the country. But in some instances, this may not be possible, and for certain types of surveys, we may actually get collections of sentinel labs who will be specifically taking part in particular projects. Irrespective of the number of sentinel labs, there are two ways of undertaking the surveillance. The most common, as I say, is to collect the data that's generated in the individual laboratories following their own in-house testing of the isolates they have. There is an alternative approach, though, where one may want to collect the bacterial isolates obtained from the patients to have the isolates referred to a central lab, often a national reference laboratory, for centralised characterisation and testing. There are, again, differing strengths and weaknesses of the two approaches. With the local testing, one is capable of collecting huge amounts of data. The problem is, though, that it's not necessarily standardised in terms of the methods that we use for testing, and also the range of antibiotics that may be tested against particular bacteria may vary quite considerably between hospitals. And so the quality of the data is not under the control of the investigators. Essentially, what you get is what you get when you're collecting it. The advantage of centralized testing does mean that you can actually test your isolates using standardized methods. And you can also test the isolates against standardized panels of antibiotics, and particularly if there are perhaps novel antibiotics that one wants to investigate, you then have the option of including these new drugs in the panels. Obviously, in terms of choosing central laboratories, geography is of paramount importance. If you're doing national surveillance, you want to make sure that all regions are adequately represented in terms of having laboratories. Also, the type of hospital that are feeding isolates into the laboratories can influence your results, because different types of hospitals may have different patient populations and different infection problems, and indeed different rates of antibiotic resistance. So these are all factors that need to be taken into account when undertaking and setting up your surveillance. So moving on to the next slide, this is just to give you some examples of data that's been generated by the Health Protection Agency using continuous surveillance. Now, the Health Protection Agency has been collecting data on cases of bacteremia. So don't worry about the problem of antibiotic resistance at the moment. We've simply been collecting information on cases of bacteremia for more than 30 years. This is national surveillance on the burden of disease that started in the early 1970s. With the increasing recognition of problems of antibiotic resistance, and indeed with the setting up of a national reference lab to study antibiotic resistance in the mid-1980s, It was decided to piggyback on the pre-existing system and to start collecting laboratory reports of susceptibility testing of isolates as well. So initially we had a system that was up and running, but from 1989 onwards, laboratories were asked to supplement their data by also sending us the results of their routine susceptibility testing. Now I should stress that this is a voluntary scheme, but nonetheless, probably the overwhelming majority of hospitals do take part. The next slide actually shows you some examples of the sort of data that this type of surveillance can generate. And what we're looking at is the proportion in percentage terms of bacteremia isolates of Staphylococcus aureus that are resistant to methicillin. So we have the percentage of MRSA amongst Staph aureus bacteremias on the vertical axis and time in years on the bottom axis, going from 1991 through to 2004. And as you'll see, we did have a problem with MRSA back in the early 90s, but it was fairly minimal. They were around, but they were comprising literally about 1 or 2% of Staph aureus bacteremias. Around about 1993, 1994, we began to be a bit worried because there seemed to be a marked increase that we were seeing in the proportion of Staph aureus bacteremias that were methicillin resistant. Now, unfortunately, this was really the thin end of the wedge, and indeed throughout the 1990s, up to about 1999, there was a dramatic increase in MRSA causing bacteremia in the country. Fortunately, from about 2000 onwards, it does appear to have plateaued or may even perhaps be just very slightly beginning to decrease. But this is vitally important data of national importance, and as I say, it was all generated as a result of this continuous surveillance activity undertaken by the Health Protection Agency. Now, this particular slide gives you some key data, but it's represented in really quite a basic form. We're simply looking at the percentage rates of resistance. As you'll see in the next slide, we can actually supplement that and give more information, again, in the same slide. So here we have two lots of data that are superimposed. If you look, you'll see a rather thin yellow line showing the proportion of strains that are methicillin resistant, which is on the previous slide, going up across from left to right. The bars that you're seeing in the histogram, this is providing additional information, and this graph is actually showing you the numbers of isolates of Staphylococcus aureus that have been isolated from blood culture, and the axis for the bars is on the left-hand side. This gives you two pieces of information. Firstly, again, you'll see that the rate of MRSA is increasing, but now you can also see that it's in the context, apparently, of increasing numbers of Staph aureus bacteremias. This means the proportion of isolates was increasing, but also the total number. Now, when one is doing surveillance, one of the key things you need to do is to be slightly cynical about the data. So, for example, in this graph, we are seeing, apparently, a marked increase in the number of isolates. Now the question is, does this mean that bacteremia due to Staphylococcus aureus was genuinely increasing in prevalence over that time period? Or might it in fact be possibly an artifact, and in fact the increasing height of the bars is simply increasing, reflecting increasing numbers of hospitals who are sending us data? And obviously these are the sorts of issues that need to be looked at in detail when generating data to avoid over-interpretation or misinterpretation of the data. And indeed, in terms of the increase in bacteremias, we believe that it's quite complex and probably is actually a reflection of both a genuine increase in the number of cases of bacteremia, but also there's a strong contribution from increasing numbers of hospitals reporting. Again, I'll just put this in really to stress that when you generate data, one does have to be always looking at it very critically and seeing if you really believe at the end of the day you've actually got the genuinely correct answer. Moving on to the next slide, I'd mentioned that all the data I've just been showing you has been generated as a result of voluntary reporting by hospitals. Given the importance of MRSA, I think clinically and indeed politically, it was felt that we needed more robust statistics on the incidence of MRSA in hospitals. So in England, the Department of Health actually made it mandatory for all acute NHS trusts in England to report annually all cases of bacteremia caused by Staph aureus and the proportion of these cases that were due to MRSA. And at the same time, 2001, similar schemes were introduced in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, but were undertaken independently. Moving on to the next slide. Of course, when one is doing this sort of surveillance, it's important to bear in mind that hospitals vary in size. And so to take a very simple example, if you have two hospitals, we'll call them A and B, and B has got twice as many beds as hospital A, they could have the same incidence of MRSA bacteremia, but hospital B would report twice as many cases because it's twice the size. So if one wants to be able to try and look at rates in different hospital trusts, but to put them on a level playing field, we need a denominator that would allow hospitals to be compared. And so they've actually gone for bed occupancy figures to be used as the denominator, and hence the rates of MRSA in individual hospitals, as reported to the Department of Health, are calculated as the numbers of MRSA bacteremias per 1,000 occupied bed days. Now, some interesting findings have come out from this sort of surveillance. If you go to the next slide, you'll see that it's possible to group trusts into broad categories, and the three main categories that are used are single specialty trusts, and these would be trusts where, as the name suggests, they tend to focus in a single specialty. So it might be an orthopaedic hospital, or perhaps a children's hospital, or maybe a cancer hospital. Now, one could argue as to whether or not all, paediatrics, for example, is a single specialty or not. But when the trusts were asked to classify themselves, single specialty trusts did tend to fall into the groups that I've described. We then have general acute trusts, and these are just your typical district general hospitals. And then we also have specialist trusts, which are hospitals that offer specialist treatment options or diagnostic tests. And as the name suggests, a patient in the general acute trust, for example, might be referred and then transferred to a specialist trust if they require specialist treatment. Looking at the MRSA rates in the three categories, you will see that there's actually quite a marked difference, with the single specialty trusts having the lowest rates of MRSA bacteremia at 0.09 per 1,000 occupied bed days. The general acute trusts were just under twice as high at 0.16 per 1,000 bed days, and the specialist trusts had the highest rate at 0.24, which is just under three times higher than the single specialty trusts. So it does seem that there are differences in MRSA rates depending on the type of hospital one's looking at. Of course, it's actually a lot more complicated than that. These are the mean figures for each of the categories, and within each of those groups, there is quite a spectrum in terms of the MRSA rates seen in different hospitals. This is in fact shown in the next slide, which is a series of trusts. Now, in fact, you're not actually supposed to be able to read the names at the bottom, although this data is actually available on the UK Department of Health website. It's actually showing a series of individual trusts for the time period April 2002 to March 2003, looking at the MRSA bacteremia rate. And as you'll see, there's quite a spectrum with the trusts on the right-hand side having considerably higher MRSA rates. This is quite a difficult area to be working in because the media and the popular press have picked up on these figures being publicly available, and have unfortunately tended to categorise trusts with high rates of MRSA as being what they refer to as broadly as dirty hospitals. Of course, the reality is a lot more complex than that. It may well indeed be that occasionally some hospitals do have problems with levels of hospital cleaning or infection control. But of course, there are other issues, and it may well be, for example, that a lot of the specialist trusts with the high rates may receive patients who are transferred from other hospitals who go to the specialist trust for particular, perhaps specialised operations or invasive procedures. Had the patients been colonised with MRSA in the first hospital, and when they're transferred they take their MRSA with them, it may well be that they become bacteremic during the course of, say, an invasive procedure or a particular operation. And as it's the rates of bacteremia that are specifically reported rather than just general rates of carriage, that statistic would then go down on the figures for the specialist trust. And indeed, the high rates that have been seen may, to some extent, perhaps reflect the patient population that's been seen in the trust. As I say, at the end of the day, it's likely to be a mixture of a whole range of things, including the patient population, the levels of cleaning, the resources put into infection control, what antibiotic policies are in place, plus probably myriad the presence or absence of isolation facilities. I mean, a whole range of factors may impact on the MRSA rates, and it can be quite difficult to entangle them, and indeed this is an area of active research at the moment. One of the benefits of coming out from this work, as I say, because obviously one wants to take action on the basis of the findings from surveillance, is that representatives of trusts with high rates of MRSA and lower rates of MRSA have been invited to meet formally with microbiologists and infection control people to help, with a view to having informal discussions and brainstorming, just trying to compare the experiences in different types of hospitals with different rates of MRSA to see if there are lessons that can be learnt. So again, it's an example of generating data which is then used to try and come up with an action point to generate a strategy for trying to deal with the problem. And obviously, surveillance over a prolonged period of time will give some indication if any of these strategies may actually work. Once this data became available, of course, as shown in the next slide, the government have actually decided to set targets. And as you will see, in late 2004, John Reid, who was then Health Secretary, he's now Home Secretary, but at that point he was still with the Department of Health, issued an edict saying that the government required bloodstream infections with MRSA to be halved in 3 years. And essentially he's asking all hospitals to achieve year-on-year reductions in their MRSA rates. And in fact, the surveillance activities I've been describing will generate the data to see if hospitals are actually meeting their targets. Of course, it will be quite fascinating if you think back to the previous graph that you just looked at, that hospitals who are at the lower end of the spectrum may well be doing extremely well in terms of having low MRSA rates, and it may be relatively difficult for them to... relatively difficult for them to actually achieve a halving of their MRSA rates. Of course, the hospitals who started off with quite high rates may, in principle at least, be in a better position or have got more leeway in terms of trying to reduce their rates, although it will depend very much, as I say, if the problems that are lending to these hospitals having high MRSA rates, depending if they're actually easy or otherwise to overcome. Moving on to the next slide. Now, I'd mentioned that these schemes were set up in England, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland all at the same time. In Wales, rather than simply collecting the basic data set as I've described for England, they decided to actually get slightly more detailed information. So they've asked the hospitals and the trusts to provide information on the rates of MRSA in different hospital units. Now, Wales actually, in a sense, have an advantage because they only have a total of 13 trusts that they have to deal with. So in terms of collecting the data, it's relatively straightforward compared to the situation in England, where we're trying to collect data from several hundred trusts. So you see that the problems in the sense between the two countries are not strictly comparable. As you will see from the Welsh data, there's quite a marked spectrum of resistance rates in different parts of the hospital. Interestingly, their overall rate for the country as a whole for the trusts was 43%, which was essentially very similar to the rate seen in England. But when you look at different hospital units, you'll see that in general surgery and intensive care units, rates are getting on for about 60%, so way above the mean figure of 43%. In contrast, haematology and general medicine are in the middle with rates of between about 41 to about 46-47%, while trauma and orthopaedics seem to have lower rates at just over 36%. And interesting, paediatrics have extremely low rates of MRSA at about just over 6%. So we're actually looking at a tenfold difference between low rates of MRSA bacteremia seen in paediatric units versus the rates of getting on for 60% seen in general surgery or intensive care units. And again, there's a lot of interest in what accounts for these differences. It's likely to be, to a large extent, we believe, a reflection of antibiotic usage. Clearly, in intensive care units, for example, a lot of critically ill patients, very prone to infections, and therefore receive a lot of antibiotics. And essentially, we believe that in settings where antibiotics are very widely used, this generates a very strong selective pressure for the emergence and then persistence of antibiotic-resistant strains. This is also shown in the next slide, where this was a study, in fact, published in CID, that stands for Clinical Infectious Diseases. It was a study from America, and it was looking at resistance rates in different parts of the hospital. And along the bottom, we've got four different categories. MR stands for methicillin resistance in coagulase negative staphylococci. MRSA is methicillin resistant staphylococcus aureus, we've been talking about. VRE stands for vancomycin resistance in enterococci, and PIP-PA is piperacillin resistance in Pseudomonas aeruginosa. And firstly, you'll see if you compare the resistance rates, which are shown on the vertical axis in percent terms on the left, that the rates of resistance for the different drug-bug combinations clearly vary quite markedly. But for all of them, the highest rates are seen with the red bars, which are patients in intensive care units. Slightly lower rates are seen in other parts of the hospital, but in non-ICU patients. And thirdly, the lowest rates are invariably seen in outpatients. And that trend is the same for all four different drug-bug combinations, clearly highlighting that certain parts of the hospital are particularly at risk in terms of having problems with emergence and spread of antibiotic-resistant organisms. In view of this and the importance of different areas of the hospital, the Department of Health in England has recently decided to expand the mandatory surveillance of methicillin resistance in Staph aureus bacteremia, and has now altered the mandatory scheme such that from late last year, hospitals are now asked to report demographic information and also information about the area of the hospital where the infections were incurring. So we hope to, in the fullness of time, generate a lot more detailed information which will enable us to look at which particular groups of patients are particularly at risk of MRSA. And obviously this is fairly fundamental information for developing interventions and control strategies. Now moving on from the situation in the hospital, we've long been concerned that MRSA, which is classically a hospital problem, as I should have said, we're actually on the next slide for those of you who haven't clicked. We're particularly concerned that MRSA, which has been a hospital pathogen, would it eventually migrate out or escape from hospitals into the community? And essentially, it was envisaged that patients leaving hospital who are asymptomatic but nonetheless carrying MRSA would take MRSA with them from the hospital environment back into the community, with possibly nursing homes as a sort of interface, with perhaps people being released from hospital back into nursing homes and then friends and relatives coming to visit, with the possibility, of course, of MRSA spreading between patients in the nursing home. So we've been long been concerned that we might see the emergence of MRSA in the community in due course. Interestingly, over the last few years, there have been dramatic reports of the emergence of MRSA in the community in a number of different countries, but much to our surprise, the phenomenon appears to be unrelated to the hospital environment. As I say, this was something which was not expected at all. If you flip onto the next slide, this is, I hope you can read it okay, this is a headline from the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, which is a weekly publication published by the Centers for Disease Control in the United States. And for those of you who are not familiar, if you in fact go in and say into Google and just type in MMWR, it will take you to the website for the CDR. And this particular report, if you see the little white arrow on the right-hand side, it's actually highlighting a report in the index of community-acquired methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus in children. And the bottom part of the slide is actually the headline reporting that there were four deaths in the late 1990s from community-acquired MRSA in Minnesota and North Dakota. And what essentially happened here were that there were a total of four children who contracted Staph aureus infection and died. And when the patients were investigated microbiologically, they were found to be infected with MRSA. The state epidemiologists went in to investigate, assuming that there would be a hospital link. But despite intensive investigation of the individual children, their family and friends, they were unable to document any clear epidemiological link to the hospital setting. Arguably, more importantly, when the strains of MRSA from these four children were investigated in the laboratory and were typed, they were found to be unrelated to the MRSA that were currently prevalent in hospitals in that area. And this appeared to be one of the earliest reports of MRSA arising de novo in the community. The community strains of MRSA have now been described in quite a few countries, and they seem to share a few common characteristics. In contrast to the hospital-acquired strains of MRSA, which are frequently resistant to quite a wide range of antibiotics, the community MRSA are commonly susceptible to a very wide range of antibiotics, with the exception of the beta-lactams. As I say, the DNA profiles indicate that they are unrelated to hospital strains, as I've seen, and so the problem appears to have emerged completely newly in the community. And a striking feature of many, if not probably all of the reports of MRSA in the community, is that the strains, when studied, appear to contain a particular virulence factor called the pantovalentine leukocidin. This is a toxin that the organisms produce, which will actually lyse white blood cells and cause various other types of cell and organ damage, and is believed to possibly contribute to the pathogenesis of the infections that are being seen. If you flip onto the next slide, you should all now be on the slide called What Does Community-Acquired MRSA Cause? From the published literature on the basis of surveillance in a number of countries, we're looking primarily at infections of skin and soft tissue infections. They do more cause more invasive disease on occasions, such as bacteremia. And if a patient is bacteremic, you may get the infection localizing in the joints to cause septic arthritis or on the heart valves to cause endocarditis. A specific type of necrotizing pneumonia has been described in a number of publications and appears to be particularly associated with some of these community strains of MRSA. But I should stress that these severe invasive infections are, relatively speaking, uncommon compared to the more common presentation of skin and soft tissue infections. From prospective surveillance studies and published reports in the literature, a particular group of patients appear to be at risk, and these appear to be children, sports teams, military recruits, and prison inmates. And this, I think, intuitively makes sense because these are all groups of individuals who are often cloistered together in close physical contact. So if you get sports teams playing contact sports such as rugby or American football or wrestling, there will clearly be plenty of opportunity for skin-to-skin transmission of these strains if they're causing skin lesions. And obviously sports teams sharing changing room and shower and bathing facilities, plenty of opportunity for transmission there. Children either in play groups or at school playing together in close contact. Military recruits in the same barracks, again, probably with communal changing facilities and washroom facilities and so on, and certainly in prisons. Clearly groups where there is a marked opportunity for person-to-person transmission of the organism if it occurs. And on the next slide, there's just a summary slide, really, just showing reported cases in the literature from different parts of the world. And as you see, there have been reports from prisoners in Canada, children in the USA, other groups not mentioned on the previous slide, men who have sex with men are also have been involved in some outbreaks of community-acquired MRSA. There's also some interest in MRSA also being associated with animals, either domestic animals, pets, or horses. And this is an area of intense interest at the moment in terms of whether or not it's coincidental that animals can contract MRSA, or whether or not the same strains are being found in animals and in humans, indicating that there may be interspecies transmission between humans and their pets. And this is obviously an area of intense interest and research activity at the moment. So moving on the next slide, as I say, I've raised the issue of surveillance in the community. And this is actually quite an important and fascinating area. As I say, most of the surveillance studies that have been undertaken to date on the problem of resistance have used data from hospital microbiology laboratories, because essentially that's the setting where large numbers of bacterial isolates are being identified and are being tested. The big problem there is that most of the data will actually refer to strains of bacteria that have been isolated from hospitalized patients. And so essentially, we're very much looking with our surveillance data at rates of resistance in hospitals. Paradoxically, the evidence is that the majority of antibiotic use is actually in the community. And the big issue is, how do we actually undertake surveillance of resistance in the community? As I say, we have a lot of data on what's happening in hospitals, but clearly we need to know more about the community, and particularly when we have a situation such as the MRSA arising specifically in the community. So how do we tackle this problem? Well, the answer is with immense difficulty. As you will no doubt be aware, general practitioners, this is on the next slide, general practitioners tend to prescribe antibiotics empirically. That's to say, the patient will come in, they will take a history, come up with a presumptive diagnosis. If they believe the patient has an infection, depending on the type of infection, they will make an educated guess as to what the most likely pathogens are causing that infection. And if they're thought to be bacteria, they'll be giving an antibiotic, and they will also take into account what they believe the likely level of resistance to particular antibiotics are. But it's all done empirically. The patients, by and large, are not sampled microbiologically. The only times when patients do tend to be sampled is if a GP has given a patient a course of treatment. The treatment clearly hasn't worked. They've come back perhaps a few days or a week later. Usually the GP will prescribe a course of a different antibiotic at that point. If the patient still doesn't appear to be responding to the antibiotic, they may decide at that point to perhaps send a sample to the hospital to investigate what's going on. So obviously, a proportion of isolates do go from GP practices to the hospital microbiology lab, and it's possible to pull this data off from the hospital database in many instances. But the problem, of course, is that we have a highly biased population of samples, because the GPs are tending to preferentially refer isolates from patients who fail treatment, and these are the patients who are likely to perhaps have resistant organisms, which is maybe why they fail treatment in the first place. And we do not have data on all the large numbers of patients who perhaps have susceptible strains and who do respond to the treatment. So it's problematic in that we don't really have sampling schemes in place, because basically GPs do not microbiologically sample their patients. So if you go on to the next slide, the question is it possible to set up studies or to perhaps have ongoing surveillance involving GPs? Well, the answer is that while this is desirable, the reality is that it's probably quite unlikely. There are a lot of factors that impact on this decision. I guess the first factor is that for GPs, there is the time factor. We're all well aware that doctors have fairly limited amounts of time available for consultation with individual patients, and we could be talking about extending the time factor for a consultation quite markedly if one's going to be taking microbiological specimens for subsequent transmission to the hospital. There were also issues about, would the results be used just for surveillance, or would they be used for patient management? If a GP is going to be sampling patients microbiologically, he may well say he will do it only if the data is processed, if the specimens are processed rapidly and the data is fed back to him in a time frame that means it can have some impact on how he manages that individual patient. And that may or may not be feasible in real terms. If it takes time to transport the specimen to the hospital, the organisms have got to be grown up, they've then got to be tested, a report has to be sent back to the GP's got to contact the patient. All that may take quite a number of days, and the question is, will that actually impact on the outcome of the majority of infections? It may or it may not. There's also the issue of, if it were to be particularly for surveillance, would patients need to give informed consent? This again would take up a lot of time, with somebody having to explain to the patients what the surveillance was all about, asking them if they will agree, perhaps signing forms. We would need ethics committee approval and so on. You know, there are lots of issues in terms of the time frames involved. Equally, if GPs were to perhaps employ practice nurses to be doing this, who could then talk to the patients, take the samples, post-test them and so on, of course this would be increased costs for GPs, would have an impact on resources. There's also the issue of who would pick up the tab for the costs of specimen transport. The workload of individual hospital microbiology laboratories would soar if all the GPs in the area were sending in large numbers of microbiology specimens routinely. Would the labs be able to cope? Would there be additional funding be available? Would the labs actually have enough space for processing all the specimens and so on? The bottom line is, who's going to pay for this sort of surveillance to be undertaken and provide the necessary resources? And at the moment, there is no infrastructure in place that allows the ready sampling of infections in the community to look at problems of antimicrobial resistance. And this is something that's the subject of active debate at present. But I'm slightly pessimistic in terms of if we see any easy answers for how we undertake surveillance in the community. Changing the subject slightly, if we move on to the next slide, I've mentioned earlier about we do a lot of international surveillance. Now, the question is this worthwhile, or is it really just an academic exercise? Well, the bottom line is that international surveillance can be crucially important, because in these days of international travel, infections with resistant organisms clearly have the potential to spread from one part of the world to another remarkably quickly. If you look on the next slide, this is one example of a known instance of a multi-resistant strain of a pneumococcus that's known to have spread globally. This was a strain that is believed to have arisen in southern Europe, either in Spain or possibly Portugal, in the late 1970s. This strain was first documented in Cleveland in the United States, when there was an outbreak in a nursery, and the local investigators decided to look at the epidemiology of what was happening in this nursery. When they characterized the isolates, they found that they were dealing with a strain of Streptococcus pneumoniae that had been originally described some years previously in southern Europe, and appeared to be the first instance of a documented intercontinental transfer of a resistant strain of pneumococcus. Subsequently, this particular clone has cropped up all around the world. Wherever surveillance has been undertaken, this strain and indeed a number of other strains of pneumococci have been found. And if we move on to the next slide, you'll see that using a DNA fingerprinting technique called MLST, now this stands for multi-locus sequence typing. As I say, you don't need to worry about the details of that, other than to appreciate that it's a way of generating DNA fingerprints for bacteria. Some 26 different clones of multi-resistant pneumococci have been recognized with the potential to spread between different countries, or certainly to spread very widely within individual countries. And these have been classified by a body known as the Pneumococcal Molecular Epidemiology Network, or PMEN. And again, if you feed PMEN into Google, it will actually come up with the website for the Pneumococcal Molecular Epidemiology Network. And if anybody was particularly interested, there's a lot of information all about the molecular epidemiology of resistant pneumococcal infections and their spread between different countries available on that website. Going on to the next slide, these international strains, they're not just of academic importance, as I say. A couple of years ago, with some colleagues, we did a study in a small district general hospital in Berkshire. This is for those in other countries, this is a county about 60 miles west of London. And over the course of a year, that's from January 2000 to March 2001, all isolates of pneumococci from patients with invasive infection were collected, and there were 56 patients who developed invasive pneumococcal disease over that time period. The isolates from the 56 patients were studied, and 18 patients were found to have had infection with a resistant isolate. 14 of these patients had an erythromycin-resistant strain, all of which belonged to the same clone, which is called the England serotype 14 type 9 clone. The three other patients who had infections with penicillin-resistant strains, again, those three isolates all belong to the same international clone, the so-called Spain serotype 9V type 3 clone. And there was one patient that had a multi-resistant pneumococcus, which again was the international clone Spain 6B type 2. So I think it's quite fascinating that over the course of 15 months in a small district general hospital outside London, that all the cases of infection with antibiotic-resistant pneumococci involved these international clones. So as I say, it's not something that's of academic interest, it's something that's actually taking place probably in your hospital as we speak. Given the interest in international surveillance, there are a lot of international surveillance schemes running. This is one of them called EARS. It stands for the European Antimicrobial Resistance Surveillance Scheme. Apology, I keep forgetting to say next slide. This is on the next slide. This involves all member states of the European Union, plus a number of non-member states. I've listed Iceland, Norway, and Switzerland, but other non-member states have joined with the passage of time. And EARS are undertaking surveillance in a number of pathogens, but the two that I've listed here are Staph aureus and Streptococcus pneumoniae. And if you move on to the next slide, this is data for MRSA rates across Europe. And essentially, if your country is coloured red or orange or indeed purple, that's bad news. You're looking at quite high rates of MRSA. The colour code is on the right-hand side of the slide. There's been a lot of concern in the UK and a lot of media coverage about the high rates of MRSA in NHS hospitals. What's not explained by the media is that, in fact, England is not unique in this regard, and that MRSA is essentially a problem of global proportions. And certainly looking at this map, you'll see clearly that it's a problem of trans-European proportions. Although, interestingly, having said that, we should notice that in North Europe, particularly Scandinavia, they still do have rates of MRSA that are in the low single figures. So there clearly are some degrees of inter-country variation that are being seen. But I should stress that the Scandinavian countries are very much the exception to what's happening in the rest of the world, where rates of 20 to 40% are not at all uncommon. Moving on to the next slide. This is a slide, again, for looking at penicillin resistance. Well, I've in fact referred to it in this slide as non-susceptibility. That's for technical reasons, but you can essentially take it as meaning penicillin resistant pneumococci. And again, we're looking at differing rates in different parts of Europe. Interestingly here, although the UK had very high rates of MRSA, we're looking at relatively low rates in low single figures of resistance to penicillin and pneumococci, and we appear to be on a par with Scandinavia. But again, some of the southern European countries, Spain, Portugal, Italy, and so on, who had high rates of MRSA, are unfortunately also looking at high rates of penicillin resistance in pneumococci. Moving on to the next slide, in addition to collecting surveillance data on rates of resistance, there are also some studies looking at the rates of antibiotic consumption. And this is a slide from a piece of work where they looked at the correlation between resistance rates and antibiotic consumption, which is on the horizontal axis. You see it says DDD, beta-lactams. That stands for defined daily dose, which is essentially a standardized way of measuring antibiotic consumption, so that you can have all the rates of consumption in different countries expressed in the same parameter. And we've got rates of resistance on the log scale going up the vertical axis. And essentially what you see is that if you compare rates of resistance to penicillin in pneumococci and rates of consumption of beta lactams, you get a broadly linear relationship between what's going on. So that's to say, on the right hand side, you see at the top of the graph ES, which is Espana, that's Spain, and it's the country that, and PT is Portugal, the countries that have the high rates of beta lactam resistance appear to have high rates of resistant organisms. And again, we believe that this is probably the widespread use of antibiotics that's creating a selective pressure for the emergence and persistence of antibiotic resistant strains. And conversely, on the graph, if you look at, say, the bottom left-hand side, Netherlands and Denmark, countries where there are low rates of beta-lactam usage with relatively low rates of resistance. Now, I should explain that this particular type of study or this graph does not prove that it is a causal relationship. This is an example of what's called ecologic epidemiology, where one's looking at broad populations. And unfortunately, what the trouble is that what you don't actually know is that in an individual country, are the patients who were infected with the antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria the self-same patients who were receiving the antibiotics? And that data isn't available for this type of study. So we can't prove cause and effect, but nonetheless, it clearly does give you a very strong index of suspicion that there is a correlation that needs investigation. Moving on to the next slide. So on the basis of this, we come up with strategies to try and reduce antibiotic resistance, because, as I say, a key aim of surveillance is to try and give pointers as to what one can do about a problem. And as we believe antibiotic use is a major driving force, there are recommendations for less antibiotic use and better tailored antibiotic use. Moving on to the next slide, this is an example of a government information leaflet prepared in the UK to be left in GP surgeries, so that patients can take them and can read and get some understanding in layman's terms about the problem of antibiotic resistance and why you do not want to be taking antibiotics unnecessarily. Moving on to the next slide. This does show you that in the UK, some of these strategies do appear to be working and that we are seeing quite a marked reduction in antibiotic prescribing with time. And this is data with levels of prescribing from 1993 down to 2003, and clearly dropping markedly during the 1990s, perhaps a suggestion of a bit of a plateau as we've hit the 2000s. Moving on to the next slide. Some examples of seeing if these interventions do actually give you a favourable outcome. In the early 1990s in Finland, they had a major problem with resistance to macrolides. These are drugs like erythromycin. And from 1992 onwards, following a national campaign, they saw reduced rates of antibiotic resistance in group A streptococci. And this led the investigators to believe that the reduction in antibiotic usage that they saw was followed by reduced rates of resistance in the group A streptococci. Unfortunately, when an independent analysis was done of erythromycin resistance rates in Streptococcus pneumoniae, they saw that the rates actually rose from 0.6 up to 2.4 a couple of years later. So again, you have a reduction in antibiotic usage followed by a decline in antibiotic resistance in one species of bacteria, but an apparent increase in the other. So this shows you that the associations between usage and resistance rates are extremely complex. If you're looking at the next slide, another example of this is data from the UK showing the use of sulfonamides. So we've got years along the bottom line from 1987 through to 1999. And you'll see that the black line, pretty much along the bottom line, is usage of sulfonamides alone. With the problem of toxicity of sulfonamides being highlighted, there was a marked decline in sulfonamide use in the 1980s. Cotrimoxazole, which is a combination of the sulfonamide and trimethoprim, has also declined in terms of usage very dramatically over the time period shown, and this has shown a compensating increase in the use of trimethoprim alone. So essentially between 1987 through to about 1999, there's been a phenomenal decrease in the utilization of sulfonamides. If you look on the next slide and look at sulfonamide resistance in isolates of E. coli from London, You'll see that in 1991, sulfonamide resistance was running at about 39%. In 1999, it had actually gone up to nearly 46%. So despite the dramatic decline in sulfonamide usage, we've seen absolutely no impact in carriage of sulfonamide resistance in E. coli. Indeed, if anything, it's gone up. And this is probably reflecting the fact that the gene encoding sulfonamide resistance is actually linked genetically to genes encoding other types of resistance. And when you have lots of different antibiotic resistance genes all located on the same genetic elements, the use of any individual antibiotic will select for the entire genetic unit. So although sulfonamides are not being used, there is probably an indirect selection pressure for the perseverance of the sulfonamide resistance gene through the use of an alternative antibiotic where resistance is actually linked on the same genetic element. So moving on to the next slide, as you see, strategies to reduce antibiotics are clearly not going to be easy. There are a number of other strategies that have been mooted. Certainly in a hospital infection, we want to look at prevention of cross-infection, so we need high standards of hospital hygiene, utilisation of isolation systems if at all possible, barrier nursing of patients and so on. All the sorts of things which will try and cut down on cross-infection with resistant strains in the hospital setting. For pneumococci, we have the imminent introduction of the new paediatric vaccines. The serotypes included in the vaccines, we know that there is good coverage of the serotypes associated with antibiotic resistance, so we're actually hoping that vaccination strategy may be followed by a marked reduction, particularly of erythromycin and penicillin resistance in pneumococci, and we will have active surveillance programs going on to monitor this. And of course, an obvious new intervention is the development of new antibiotics, which with activity against strains of bacteria that are resistant to currently available antibiotics. So a wide range of different strategies that are being adopted. And of course, the bottom line is, will any of them actually work? And essentially, only continued surveillance will actually give us the answers.
Can I just thank you then briefly for an excellent teleclass? It's been really interesting, a very interesting topical subject and very informative and thought-provoking. It does make me think about what's ahead, yes. You know, the post-antibiotic era for our generation.
Oh, absolutely.
So thank you very much for that, Alan.
You're welcome.
And hopefully we can all hear each other tuning in again in the future. Thank you very much and goodbye.
Thanks.